Harvey.
Yes.
Hey, this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron here. We got a
Hey, how you
great, we've got a couple co-hosts. We call them Psychic Tom Paget and Tony the Tornado Penical.
Hello, how you guys doing?
Great.
All right.
So,
Yeah.
I was telling the guys we sort of met through Roy Jones Jr., even though he didn't introduce us.
Okay.
We were battling over his signature. But and we saw your profile and I said, "Oh boy, he's a big referee. Had a big fight
Yeah.
recently." So tell us how you got into that.
This is my 20th year in the pro game. I did 6 years in the amateurs and by the force to becoming a pro, but I was fortunate enough to have gotten selected, and I've like I said, been at it ever since. I think I've done over 100 professional bouts in 20 years, and yeah, I've just been a little fortunate over the last few years.
Awesome. And I
So
know.
Harvey, I was going to ask, you are coming off doing maybe the biggest fight of the year, without a doubt. What was the atmosphere like out for that one? And what was it like being in there? Two great fighters. I'll be honest. I was, this might sound corny, but it was just like any other fight to me. And what I mean by that is, I know it was a big fight, but for me, in terms of going through the same mental and physical preparations that I do, I didn't. It was no different than any other fight for me. Because you have the same job to do, and that's maintain the health and safety of the fighters, and make sure they're adhering to the rules. So this was for me almost like another fight, if that makes any sense.
Right. Now,
That makes perfect sense.
when you go into a fight like that, you're going to be the referee. Do you even think about, like, I wonder who's going to win, and like make a prediction at all in your own mind?
Not at all. No. My mind is strictly on, adhering to or making sure they're adhering to the rules and regulations, and I'm going through my steps, and I am aware of where I am in the ring at the time, because so much of the sport is positioning and angles and feeding off their movements, and so just making sure you're in the moment, and not making it any given any other fight.
Awesome.
Just going through the steps you always go through in your head, whatever they may be. So for me, yeah, it was just another fight.
Right. Well, I imagine that's why you keep getting picked for these big fights, because you treat them all the same, because that's what a good judge or referee or anybody that's supposed to be objective would do. That's great.
I think any good official in any sport, just maintaining objectivity and just making calls that are presented in front of you is, I think, what gives you a clear focus on the task at hand. So yeah, that's objectivity is a big part of it.
Now, I ask every referee we've had on the show, it's not a whole lot, but we've had a few. The late Steve Smoger was probably the last one we had on. But have you ever been hit in a fight by a fighter by accident or on purpose?
I'm gonna find some wood and knock on it. As of right now, I'd say no, but I'm still young in my career, so anything is possible. I have fallen down a few times.
Oh, trying to get out
Yeah,
of the way.
I've slipped a couple of times,
Yeah.
but I haven't been hit yet.
I'll never forget it.
So.
It's Tyson versus Douglas. Everybody's talk about the long count, but I had it on tape, video cassette, back in the VCR days. And I used to love watching the moment where, I don't forget where it was, Tyson or Douglas, but one of them hit the ref square in the face. And he reacted so well. He just like put his hands on both of them. And he goes, "Hey, hey, hey, none of that." Let the fight continue.
There's videos of referees actually getting hit really hard. There's been a couple of refs that have been actually knocked out cold. So you know, that's certainly not the road I want to travel down. But you know, things do happen in that ring, and it can happen.
I'll tell you, the first time I remember seeing that happen, I was 13. And we were visiting my grandmother. She was in the hospital, and I was coming home to watch Tuesday Night Fights because, you know, I was a diehard boxing fan. Couldn't miss Tuesday Night Fights. And that night was supposed to be, originally, George Foreman was going to fight. He was in the middle of his comeback. He hadn't fought Holyfield yet. He hadn't fought Moore yet. He was really just a year or so into it. And they ended up postponing the Foreman fight. And they ended up showing a card from the Blue Horizon, which is my hometown of Philadelphia. And long before I'd ever gone to a fight there, and I'm watching it, and it ended up being a fight of the year with Vincent Petway, who later became a world champion, and a perennial contender by the name of Victor Davis. And those two were tearing into each other. And the late, great Frank Cappuccino was the referee. And in the eighth or ninth round, right at the end of the round, someone caught him square. And he went down, and they actually had to bring in another referee for the next round, and then Frank came back the round after that.
Wow. Yeah.
I'll never forget that.
And Frank Cappuccino, he's one of the greats, one of the treasures of our sport. He refereed that first fight between Mickey Ward and Arturo Gatti.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. And Buddy McGirt would say that after that ninth round, when he thought they were going to stop the fight, they didn't know what was going on because he goes, Frank Cappuccino and Arturo Gatti were speaking Italian in the corner, and Buddy McGirt couldn't understand them. Right. Yeah. So that's a classic because that ninth round was such a great, great round. Because it looked like Gotti was definitely out of it, and Frank let him go. And Gotti wound up fighting his way out of. Well, I can't think of a better word to say, but he was in hell in that ninth round. Somehow battled back, and I'm just thinking if that were to happen today, I think 99% of the refs would have stop the fight today, but Frank, he showed why he's as great as he was. Being able to see that Gotti was, you know, able to come through that. I don't think too many other refs would have had the foresight to see that.
When Arturo passed in 2009, I was a fan of Arturo, and ironically, the first card that I went to as a fan, I was 15, was Michael Moore and Burt Cooper, the 1992 Fight of the Year. And I was a 15-year-old kid, and Arturo was fighting his fifth or sixth pro fight on the undercard. And I just knew because the song Thunderstruck played. And I became an instant fan. And I followed his whole career. I went to his third fight with Mickey Ward in Atlantic City. And then I went to his second to last fight when he challenged Baldomir for the title, and he got stopped. A year later, he retired. And when he retired, I was doing a lot of writing for this website, and I wrote a tribute article. And then 2 years later, he was taken from us too soon, and I rewrote the foreword to that tribute article and then republished it. And the one thing I said was I talked about going to the third Mickey Ward fight and how electric it was in the Atlantic City Boardwalk Hall. And then I also said the first fight, I was invited to two graduation parties that night, and I actually used the other party as a way to get out of both of them. So I I said, no, I got this college friend's party. No, I got my cousin's party. And I'm like, I was skipping them both. And they're like, you have. have to go to your cousin's party for an hour. I went for an hour, and then I drove home at about 100 miles an hour. And here's how I described it. I said, some fights you watch on the edge of your seat. Some fights you watch standing up. And some fights you're so into it, you're actually drawing punches.
Now, do you have?
Do you have? What's interesting about those two is that after they battled those three fights, Mickey Ward wound up working on Churro Gotti's corner for a few fights afterwards.
Yeah, he walked into the ring a few times, and then he was his lead trainer for Churro's last fight.
Yes. So that's a very special bond they formed with each other.
When they did that HBO documentary a couple years ago, Legendary Nights, and obviously Arturo at that time had passed, and they were showing clips of him going into the Hall of Fame, and they were talking about, you know, his career and his, you know, trilogy with Mickey Ward. And the one thing Mickey Ward said, and I actually choked up when he said this, when they were at Arturo's funeral, and they were walking by the casket, and he goes, I had to hit the casket with a left hook and say, I got you last.
Wow. Yeah. Their bond was truly special. I mean, you often see guys who go to war with one another in the ring and then wind up very good friends outside of the ring. So, I'm not surprised. And I'm sure they'll link up with each other again in the afterlife. That was a special bond they had, and they provided us with one of the greatest fights. That first fight is one of the greatest fights of all time.
For sure.
You know, as you were saying that, how a lot of fighters, and I'm sure you've seen it as well, guys, you maybe refereed, and when it was over, you know, not only did they have a mutual respect for each other, but they had a mutual friendship with each other. Even I know, during my amateur days, I was fighting a guy, I moved up two weight classes to fight him. I had to put rocks in my pocket to make the weight, and I go to fight this guy. He was a heavyweight. He had me by about 6 inches in height and about almost, at the time, 25 pounds in weight. And I fought him hard, but he got me by decision. But we had such a respect for each other that when he won a national title the following year, I was one of the first ones there because I had already finished my tournament to greet him coming out of the ring. And then years later, we went to an Arturo Gotti fight together when he fought Baldemir. And then a few years after that, we were both auditioning for the one Rocky movie. And I had just come out of having my appendix removed, and I shouldn't have been at the audition. And he saw me there, and he said, listen, you look really bad right now. I will take care of you. I will make sure that you get to your car. I will make sure that your ride picks you up. I will make sure that you can walk out of here, you know, on your feet. That's a friendship from two guys that beat the hell out of each other.
Boxing is weird like that.
So there's a similar story I just heard about, I think within the last week, about Rick Bowe and Evander Holyfield. I heard they're living with each other now, and Holyfield is, for the most part, Rick Bowe's caregiver, for lack of a better word.
Yeah,
they're living with one another down in Florida. I can't 100% verify that, but that's what I was informed of within the last week.
Yeah, we actually interviewed Riddick. We got connected with somebody who was doing some kind of charity work with him, and he was about to do some Muay Thai fight overseas. And he had never done a Muay Thai fight, so I don't think he was ready for it. He ended up getting leg kicked, you know, through the ropes, basically, in the first round. But when we interviewed him, he was still sharp enough to answer questions and stuff like that. But, you know, you could tell that there was some mental decline a little bit. And he actually... I'm sure he was joking around, but he actually at one point was like, my next opponent is going to be you, he says to me. I was like, whoa.
Yeah. I mean, he still has his inner spirit.
Yeah, definitely.
Despite the damage that he's had to endure from a long career.
And it's one of the things that, you know, he doesn't really end up getting a lot of money out of it himself, but John Scully does a lot of these reunions. He does a lot of these auctions that we both got involved in. And I went to one of them down in Boston at Dana Rosenblatt's bar there across from the Garden. And man, these people, the way they react to each other when they haven't seen each other in 10 or 15 years, in some cases, or even longer. It's just, you can't describe it. It's amazing. And that's just the bond that boxing brings to different people. Like, you know, and a lot of these are amateur boxing reunions. You know, that's how long it's been. And these guys have been in the pros for years, and they come back and they see, haven't seen each other since the amateurs. And it's therapeutic for some of them. Like Peter McNeely was one of the happiest people at that reunion. It was very therapeutic for him.
Yeah, I think Iceman Scully does a great job in raising funds for these fighters and getting them all together. I think he has an annual get-together in New York. I think this year they got together on the weekend that I actually refereed. It was the same day. I officiated a fight at the Hulu Theater. Oh. And so he had a get-together with a lot of the older fighters who've competed with one another. So, yeah, he does a great job in raising funds and helping these guys, you know, get on their feet and just maintain guys who suffered a great deal in the ring. So it's very honorable what he does.
Yeah, I was just amazed every day. He keeps pushing and doing what he does, and he's going to be doing this other one at the Ali training camp.
Yeah, that's in 2 weeks from this weekend.
Yeah, I told him. Okay. He was looking for a car to get like five of these boxers to this event, and I told him, you know, I had to go to a reunion not too long ago, and the dealership that had worked on my truck kind of screwed up the fuel intake and like zip tied it to the dump bed. Yeah, it's like, so I brought it back to them, and I wasn't like really pissed. I was classy about it. And then, you know, I was thinking about it, and I said, well, you know, I don't really, I'm not going to want to take my dump truck to three states down, you know, or two states down here. So I ended up talking to the guy, and I said, you guys ever rent vehicles or anything? And he said, no, you can do a 24-hour test drive though. So he gave it to me for free. All I had to do is give him the license. So I said, Scully, you know, you're down there in Hartford. Call a couple of these dealerships. Tell them what you're using it for. And just tell them that you'll go around selling it to people, saying, hey, this is, look at all the features this thing has everywhere you go. And I bet you they'll love to do it for you. Yeah.
So, oh, absolutely.
He's just afraid to ask sometimes. But, you know, a couple of phone calls, he could get that done. I know he could. Get a big Escalade.
Right. Yeah. He's really remarkable. I really admire what he does, though.
Yeah.
You know, so, because so many guys are who spilt their blood and given everything of themselves.
Yeah.
They, you know, they're a shell of themselves in these later years, and you know, they're long forgotten. And, you know, to show that they haven't been forgotten is, I think it's just, it's really, really a great thing what he's done. I don't know if you call it a foundation, but what he continues to do is just awesome.
Yeah. Eventually he should be able to get there. I know that he's talked about a couple people are trying to help him with that.
Okay. That's awesome. That's awesome. I've, and my very, very small part, I've gotten a few things in his auctions. But that's just a very small part of what he does. Just remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah, we got to get him back on the show. We've had him on the show like 4 or 5 times over the years. And
yeah.
I only met him in person a couple times, but yeah, he's just a great guy. And, he knows everybody. Everybody.
Yeah, yeah, he's very, very knowledgeable. I actually worked, I refereed about, I think, at the Hulu Theater where he was in the corner of Arts of Viterbia.
Oh, yeah. That's the one guy he's really big on training right now. And
yes,
he doesn't talk much about it, you know, except when he writes his own articles and stuff like that, and he gets interviewed sometimes about it. But he's kind of like one of many, and you know, with Viterbia having a lot of family involved, like it's a couple times it's gotten to the point where like some of the family have been jealous of how much influence Scully has on Viterbia, you know. And you know, like, you know, kind of warning him not to get too close and stuff a couple of times, but he's definitely made an impact, I think. One of my favorite fighters of all time for his jab, Bad Chad Dawson, was one of Scully's earliest guys. And he did a fabulous job with developing that jab. Favorite jab of all time for me.
Yeah, Bad Chad. I was working some fights in Connecticut a few weeks ago when Chad Dawson was in the corner of a young boxer. Pretty sure he had less than 10 pro fights. And Chad was, he went from fighter to trainer now. So I guess he's following
Scully's footsteps. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, a lot of it happens in both MMA and boxing. A lot of fighters like have to end up doing that. I just saw a rant from Philadelphia guy Tony Knows, Kaufman. About how you know he's working a job now, and he always thought his boxing money would be there, and he's went on this big rant about all the people he helped aren't there for him now.
You know, he was a little bit too willing to give out to people that were not just, they were using them.
Yeah.
Right.
So, that's a sad story of the typical boxer, unfortunately. Money comes in, the entourage takes half of it.
Right.
You end up wondering where your retirement money is.
Harvey, you'll appreciate this. I'll tell you a funny referee story. We were just talking about Scully training Beterbiev. Yeah. 2 years ago, they were doing a unification fight in Philadelphia between Beterbiev and Golovkin. I think I'm pronouncing it correct. So, you know, my dad and I were like, yeah, we're going to go to the fight. You know, down at Temple is only about 45 minutes from where I live. So, you know, we get pretty good seats. And one of the first things on the card is the one young fighter on the card is a Philly kid by the name of Sonny Canto, who trained out of my old gym. And he had been sparring with Tyson Fury a couple years ago when he was just breaking into his pro career. And Fury was champ of the world. So we're sitting there, and the kid next to me goes, oh, my dad was down talking. He goes, Fury's going to walk him to the ring. We're like, yeah, kid, yeah, right. That's a BS story. Then you look out towards the little island, and you see a hulking figure and a bald head. We're like, he really is. There's Tyson Fury right there. So Sonny went to his first round, and then the main event's about to start. And my friend, I don't know if you're familiar with a guy, I don't think he's refereeing anymore, by the name of Gary Rosato.
Yes, I know Gary Rosato. Yes.
Gary, I just saw his son last week, but Gary is a very good friend of mine. He started the boxing program at my alma mater, Lock Haven. So I've known Gary for about 30 years, and he was the referee of this fight. Now, I'm sitting in a section which is primarily Ukrainian, and in the first round, Gary calls a knockdown that ends up getting overturned, but the fans in that section were so incensed. And then as the fight's progressing and Beterbiev is really starting to dominate, the fans are still not letting go of this first round knockdown call. And the point where my dad and I were walking out and we were like, man, if we see Gary Rosato, we're going to cover our heads. They're like, because if we see the Ukrainians, know that we know him, they're going to beat the hell out of us, too.
Yeah. No, Gary's a really good referee. I don't know what his status is at the moment, but I hope he's able to get himself back in the ring.
Well, I know this, and like I said, I just saw his son last week at a Phillies game, and I'm walking into the place before the game, and a guy looks at me and repeats my first and last name, which I'm like, well, that's kind of weird, you know, and the guy's like, my father is Gary Rosado, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm like, you're Garrison Rosado, I never met you, but I know you, and I said to him, I said, man, your dad refereed a couple of my fights. And the one thing he said to me one time, I took a pretty hard knockdown in the one fight. And when I got up, he goes, anybody else, I might have stopped there, but not you.
Wow.
Yeah, obviously an amateur fight, but you're faster to call an A count, faster to stop a fight. But he goes, your eyes might have been a little glassy, but you were like, I'm good. And he goes, and with you, I know you are.
Wow. That's awesome. That's awesome. Knowing your personnel. Awesome. Yeah.
Now, Harvey, what would you say?
Cappuccino and Arturo Gatti, right?
I was just going to say that. Yeah, that's knowing your personnel well. Yeah. Absolutely.
Harvey, what would you say was your most difficult fight to referee of all time, if you had one?
Difficult. You know, a lot of the difficult fights are your fights with guys are just turning pro, and they don't have a good sense of the rules, or they might be fighting off a lot of nervous energy. So I think some of your toughest bouts are early in your career, the 4- and 6-round bouts.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of rule breaking, and those are much more rule breaking in those fights than the 12-round fights. And I say that because by the time fighters, if they hang around long enough to get to the 10-round and 12-round level, they typically don't get to that level by breaking a lot of rules. So more times than not, your bouts are a little bit easier on the 12-round and 10-round level than the 4- and 6-round level. So, yeah, to answer your question, there's no one fight that jumps off at the top of my head, but the 4-rounders and the 6-rounders, those can be pretty difficult. So, you might see things you don't typically see in, let's say, a championship fight with two, more novice guys that have just turned pro. You know, you're liable to see anything in some of those beginner fights. So, I've had a few, but nothing that jumps off the top of my head. And even if I knew the names of the fighters, I don't think anybody would know who they were.
How about a favorite? Do you have a favorite fight that you refereed? Do you remember fondly? Was good action?
I don't know if I have a favorite, but I know one fight that a lot of fans really enjoyed. Maybe right up there with the most action-packed fight that I've officiated was, I believe, Leo Santa Cruz and Carl Frampton. They basically went toe-to-toe for 12 rounds. that was a barn burn. They just went at it. So, I think that was one of my more exciting bouts.
Awesome.
Yeah, Leo, I don't think you could put in a bad fight.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely agree with you.
Well, I know Psychic Tom Padgett's got to be itching to ask you a question.
Well, Harvey. not really a question, but I'm just so thrilled and happy to be able to give you a personal congratulations on the job you did in that Spence Crawford fight. I just rewatched it when I knew you'd be on the show. I watched it live.
Okay.
And you just reacted just so professionally, because when that jab put Spence down, I was like, oh my God.
the referee can be overbearing and lead the show, you want that. But everyone knew you were in control. And that's professionalism. It's almost like in football, the offensive lineman does their job and they don't really get the credit like they should. But when they're the story, they're controversial. But that one you came to like, wow. And I hope you get more big assignments like that. Again, outstanding effort. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you for the acknowledgement. It's just doing my job. But no, I appreciate you acknowledging the job that I did. I appreciate that. As referees in any sport, the way I look at it is if you do a decent job, you really shouldn't. I don't feel there should be a lot of acknowledgement. I think you do the job you're supposed to do. The athletes are the ones who deserve the stories, you know. Because that's
okay. Writer who doesn't want to be part of the story,
and
right?
And you know, like a Crawford Spence fight or a NBA game, an NFL game. The people are not paying to see that official. They're paying to see those athletes. So if you can get out of there and no one knows who actually did the fight, I think that's a big compliment for me. I used to like when I did a fight, you know, this was years ago, and I'd go and look at articles the next day, and if my name wasn't mentioned, I'm like, success. That was good enough for me, you know? Because like you said, they know when you screw up. But if you do a good job, no one really notices. And
exactly.
For me, that's fine. I don't mind not being acknowledged, because to me, that's a sign that, you did a decent job.
So take us back to the very beginning for a second and tell us how you developed your love for boxing and how you got where you got today.
Well, I started amateur boxing in the late 80s. I won a few tournaments in the early to mid 90s. And, you know, I knew at that point in time I wasn't good enough to become a world champion. I was, you know, just good enough to win some local tournaments. And throughout those years, I really, really loved the sport. But, you know, knowing that I wasn't going to be any kind of world champion, but still wanted to be a part of the sport, I said, well, what can I do next besides competing? And officiating was just the natural next step. But during all of these years, from amateur boxing to becoming a professional referee, I even had one pro fight in between. Throughout all of those years, I always loved the sport. Even to this day, I'm a huge fan of the sport. Over 20 years, I've been going out to Las Vegas every year just to see a big fight.
Awesome.
You know, just as a fan.
Yeah.
So, it's been embedded in me for years now, more than half my life. So,
awesome.
I'm sure I'll be a part of the sport somehow, some way, hopefully, until I'm no longer here. I'll tell you a real quick, funny story about my love for the sport of boxing. I remember on the phone, I was about my early 20s, very single at the time. And I was on the phone with this young lady, and she was just chewing into me about something. I don't know what it was, but she was, I guess, telling me why she was upset about something I did or didn't do. And in the back... And she heard in the background while she's just pouring her heart out about, you know, whatever it was at the time, either something I did or didn't do. She can hear the bell ringing from a fight on TV. She looks at pouring her heart out, and I'm watching the fight. And she was came first for me. So,
right.
Yeah. So that's my funny Boston story, and just a quick example of my love for the sports.
Awesome.
Is that one of the ones where you make a mistake when they're in the middle of like telling you something really important and you react to what's going on the TV? Like, oh, did you see that? Are you not listening to me?
Yeah.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. But yeah, so yeah, my love for the sport, it's been with me, you know, since I've been, I guess, about 15 years old, and I'm 52 now, so do the math. It's always been a huge part of my life for a very long time. I'm hoping it doesn't change. It's just a strong passion of mine.
Awesome.
I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Now, what's been the fighter or fighters that really impressed you the most seeing them live when you refereed their first fights?
I don't typically look at I'm typically not impressed with the fighters when I'm in there. You know, I don't look at it from the perspective of let me see, how do I say? I'm not looking at the fighters for their skills and how they impress me while I'm in there.
Right.
If that makes sense. While I'm
looking for violations and where to break them.
I'm looking at it from the perspective. And that's it, you know, because there's certain things I'm anticipating, I'm looking for, and just trying to, you know, follow certain steps in my head that's going to, you know, make me not successful, but just try not to screw things up while I'm in there. And so I don't know if I'm looking at it from a being impressed point of view, but I do know, what I will say is that there were two fighters whose hand speed was absolutely insane to me. And I remember the thoughts that went through my mind. I'm like, oh my goodness, the hand speed was insane. One of them was Gary Russell Jr., and another one was a young Adrian Broner. And they both had such fast hands.
Yeah.
It was like a blur when they threw combinations. And I've rarely seen hand speed like those two showed me. And it was just like, wow, while I was in there. But, I was impressed with their speed. But other than that, I'm really just looking at the two fighters who are in there from an official's perspective, which doesn't allow me to, you know, get too overly impressed with whatever they're doing, because I'm concerned with what I have to do.
How did they do it back in the – makes you wonder how they did it back in the day where the refs actually had to judge fights.
I can't imagine. I couldn't imagine because
– I do see why you have to keep it separate. Yeah. Because if you do have a favorite fighter, you know, it's like, oh, geez, I'm going to lean towards more like, you know, helping that fighter out if I feel that way. So you got to separate it. You know, it's like a mentality you have to have, like a judge who's not biased.
Could be one of the reasons why we have judges now.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, the judges is, you know, being 52 now, getting a little older, it wasn't that long ago where judges were non-existent. I mean, it wasn't that long. I think there were fights as recently as the 70s where some of the referees were judging the bouts. I think it went from just the one arbiter, the referee, scoring a bout, telling you who won when the fight was over. And then maybe in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken, they had the referee and two judges. And then maybe by the late 80s, late 70s, they were using three judges.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not that long ago. So,
right.
But I think that's def- it was definitely a move for the better to have three judges as opposed to the referee having the responsibility of judging and refereeing.
Yep.
At least that's how I see it. I wouldn't want that responsibility.
Now, as far as the sport itself, all time, do you have a favorite fight or fighter that you've watched throughout the history of the sport and try to either, you know, copy yourself as a fighter or you just love to watch over the years?
Well, my favorite fighter of all time is Sugar Ray Leonard. And when I was competing as an amateur, there was just no way to be like Sugar Ray Leonard. I couldn't even try to be like Sugar Ray Leonard. He's one of one as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But that entire era in the early 80s, that's my my golden era. So a lot of fighters that a lot of people know about are guys that I really looked up to and admired. So from that era, you know, you obviously had the four Kingsmen, Leonard Hearns, Hagler, Duran, but there were so many other great fighters from that era. And even going into the 90s, there were so many fighters that I enjoyed watching. And even fighters that weren't as popular as the four Kings from the 80s that I still enjoy. Guys like Chiquita Gonzalez and Michael Carbajal. Those kind of guys, Kenny McKinney,
okay.
You know, I just enjoyed a lot of good fighters, and they didn't have to be like all-time greats for me to enjoy them. You know, they were guys that I just really enjoyed the way they fought. And the sport itself, it consists of guys that I just admire and look up to.
But, you know, remember, we got to watch them every week on free TV. I was around in those days a lot, too. And it was just so exciting. You know, every week we had something on. Great era. Wish we could get it back.
Well, that's why you hear a lot of fans and who grew up in that era say fighting isn't what it used to be. That's because you don't get a chance to see all of the fighters like you used to see them back then on Channel 2 out of 7, because guys like Ray Leonard, Boom Boom Mancini, Salvador Sanchez, all of those guys, they were fighting on free TV from the beginning of their career. So by the time they got onto the world stage and were challenging for titles, you knew who they were for years. So when fans now or those older generation say it's not what it used to be, that's why. Because now you don't get a chance to see these guys coming up anymore.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the one thing that really, and I've noticed this over the last maybe 20-some or 30 years now, that really, I think, hurts it a lot. And one of them was consistent programming. So even though you weren't getting as much on your Saturday afternoon, ABC, CBS, that you were still getting your consistent, you knew ESPN Thursday night, or then they did Sunday for a while, but Thursday night ESPN, you had Al Bernstein and Barry Tompkins. And then you knew on Tuesday nights, you had Tuesday Night Fights, you had Al Albert, Sean O'Grady, and you knew that. And the other thing that I really used to like was getting Ring Magazine and KO Magazine. Every 4 years before the Olympics, you would get a preview of who was on the United States team, and they would break down each guy. I remember when I was really starting to get into it in like around like the late 80s again, and I was following the 88 team, which was guys like Roy Jones and Riddick Bowe and Ray Mercer and those guys. Then you had the 92 team, which had Oscar De La Hoya, the 96 team, Floyd Mayweather, Tarver, David Reed, Vargas. And you read each guy, and then, so when they started their pro career, and a lot of them were fighting on USA's Tuesday Night Fight, you said, I read about this guy, he was in the Olympics, and now I'm interested in following his career. They stopped doing that probably after the 04 team, I think it was. So by the time you got to 08, you didn't even know who was on the U.S. team. And Olympic boxing wasn't getting shown like it was. So these guys are coming out, and you're like, oh, this guy was Olympian. I'm like, oh, he was? Didn't know that. So, I mean, I think that hurts a lot with lack of consistent programming, even if it wasn't, even if it was a cable channel, USA or ESPN, and then just the lack of, you know, really building up these young guys.
Yeah, no, I agree 100% with you. Absolutely. You don't get a chance to see who these guys are. You don't see them on a consistent basis. The programming is almost non-existent. It's very tough to follow these guys now. I mean, you have to, and then as you get older, and there's so many different types of streaming services, it's hard. It's probably a lot easier for the younger guys to keep up with these streaming services and how to.
I'm still amazed sometimes when somebody shows me
technology, but as you get older, it becomes more and more difficult to find fights, and it's just a lot more difficult to follow these guys. So I'm with you 110%. And to piggyback off of what you said about the Olympics, yeah, I mean, in the last few years of the Olympics, the boxing, you never know when it's coming on. And a lot of times it's coming on at 2 and 3 in the morning, and, you know, you never know when it's coming on. And, yeah, that's one reason why you don't know who these guys are when they turn pro.
And they changed the scoring system, that computerized scoring system that took a lot of the fun out of it. Like, I even know, going back and watching, one of the ones that you mentioned him a few minutes ago, Ray Leonard. Now, he won the Olympic gold a few months before I was born in 76. But I'll still go back and watch some of his fights in the Olympics just because it was just, the best word he used was dazzling. And when he turned pro, and I was, you know, just growing up, he would be fighting a lot on, you know, free TV, and I used to love to watch him with my dad. Loved watching Ray Leonard with my dad. And when I was about 4 or 5 years old, my dad bought me a little Sugar Ray Leonard bag to hit. And I have a picture where I'm hitting it with my big left hook. I was 5 years old. And a couple years ago, I saw him in Vegas. And unfortunately, it was at a convention, and his line was so long, and I had to go. So I was going to meet my dad because we were going into the Canelo fight. And I'm like, if I could stay another 30 minutes, that's the one guy I was going to show him that picture and say, this meant so much to me as a kid.
Yeah. Ray Leonard was special. And yeah, those times that we grew up with the sport and knowing who those guys were, that whole special place is in our hearts. So you have your special place in your heart watching those guys with your father. And a lot of us had that growing up, seeing young boxers come out of the Olympics and turn professional. That was just a big part of your upbringing, being associated and attached and having those fond memories of your athletic heroes. And for boxing nowadays, unfortunately, it just doesn't exist. And sometimes you have some really, really good fighters, and people just don't know how special they are. Like, I don't think Andre Ward ever captured the public imagination like the Ray Leonard did.
Right.
Because, you know, when he turned pro, people just weren't that familiar with him. Because I think the 2004 Olympics, and by that time, they just weren't showing boxing like they did when you and I, me seeing the 76 Olympics, you seeing those guys from 88, Roy Jones. That was special. I mean, and everybody got a chance to see that. And I don't know if people can appreciate how good you have to be to come out of the Olympics, let alone win the Olympics, and then transition into your pro career. But that was the springboard. The Olympics, if you made the Olympic team, and definitely if you medaled, more or less got a gold medal, that was your springboard to stardom. Now it's like you get a gold medal and you're still, for the most part, in somewhat of obscurity for a lot of fans.
Except for Clarissa Shields. She's done pretty well with it. She's about the only one. She's the anomaly.
Talking about Andre Ward, like I remember when he won the Olympic gold, And I did follow his career because I liked him. I liked him not just as a fighter, but as, you know, just the way he spoke in the ring, the way he conducted himself. You know, I always saw him as a constant gentleman. And I never got a chance to meet him in person. But on the Creed 2 set, I sat 5 feet from him when he was filming the scene when he loses to Michael B. Jordan at the beginning. Okay. I was a front row extra in his corner. So wow. I'm sitting there, and there's a kid sitting maybe a section down from me. And he was like an off-the-screen extra, and he's sitting there talking like, I'm going to be champ of the world, and he's telling all this stuff. I'm like, you haven't had any fights, kid. And then they need me to go in the ring and show them how to do this. I'm like, you know that's Andre Ward, gold medalist and like 3-time world champion, that you're going to go tell what to do? I've never heard of him. I'm like, exactly. As a fan, I think you'll appreciate this. And this was, I was really getting into boxing at this time when this happened. And it's unfortunate, and it was at a non-televised show before you had digital cameras. Because to my knowledge, there is no recording of this anywhere. 1994, I was just graduating high school, and my dad takes me to a show 4th of July weekend in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia is the home of Smokin' Joe Frazier, who was still alive. I had just met him a few months prior for the first time. And he was going to be, it was a Welcome America boxing card. And not only was Smokin' Joe going to be there, but so was Muhammad Ali. And Ali was starting to show the signs of the Parkinson's. A couple years before, he was really shaking doing the Olympic torch. So Joe gets in the ring, and of course, the Philadelphia crowd is, you know, going crazy. Joe's in there. And then you see Ali starting to get in the ring, starting to shuffle up them steps very slowly. He has his head down. He steps in that ring, and he looks up, and he sees Joe Frazier, and his eyes gleamed. And he started dancing around the ring, just like he was, like, 22 years old. And he started doing the Ali shuffle. And Joe, I know there was some bitterness between them, but Joe picked up on it, and he dropped into the crouch and doing the bob and weave. Now, I was born a year after Manila. Right. And I knew both of them. I had watched videos of them, but I was looking at grown men in that crowd with tears streaming down their face. And to this day, I can find no video of it, but I know where it is. It's still captured in my mind, and I can still see them both.
Wow. That touches me, just hearing it and seeing it. Oh, my goodness.
Like, when they did the Joe Frazier statue, and it's going to be 8 years next week, because it was dedicated on Marvis's birthday, which happened to be the day before my birthday. And I was going to a Phillies game right across the street, right at the foot of the old Philadelphia Spectrum, which is now like a nightclub and a restaurant. And they were doing the statue dedication. It took them a couple of years to get the funds raised for it, and it took them a couple of years to fight where they were going to put it. So that day, I'm down there early for a game, and Rich knows I like to do video editing. So I took a bunch of photos. And I have guys, because I'm dressed up in my Phillies outfit, which is a replica of Apollo Creed. And I have guys like Michael Spink coming up to me for photos, Ivan Robinson, brother Nazim Richardson, who recently passed away. And I'm taking pictures for all these guys. And then there were guys that I trained with that were there that had never seen me in character. And I actually fed it to the song "Ain't No Stopping Us Now." I made a video of it. When Rich and I went to the Rocky Marciano statue dedication, which is going to be 11 years in a few weeks, I was invited up there by Rocky's nephew because they found out that my uncle was at the fight in Philly when Rocky won the title. So they invited me up. Rich was doing some work for their website at the time. And I did the same thing. I took all the photos, and I took the song from Rocky V by Elton John, Measure of a Man, and I did the same thing. I made a video out of it.
Now, Don King actually I was not a big fan of him at the time. I still am not. But John King actually gave one of the best speeches at the Rocky Marciano dedication.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
Yeah. He's provided
a comic Rocky Marciano was not a racist man. He didn't care if you were white. He didn't care if you were black. You could be yellow. Because all Rocky did was he knocked you out any color you were. He knocked them all out equally. you know what? I'll say this. That's awesome. The work you've done. Let me give you a quick my feelings about Don King and boxing today. I hear a lot of people today complain about the pay-per-view fights, about, you know, you don't get the bang for your buck. But Don King, love him or hate him, he used to give you bang for your buck. He gave you four title fights on one card, and one of those fights could have held their own on their own, and he would give you four. And I believe a lot of times they were only like $40 or $50. I mean,
I remember those days.
He knew how to put on a show, that's for sure.
You would get a Don King card, or you might Mike Tyson be in the main event, but you would get Tony Norris on the undercard. Right? He was the one that opened the door for Christy Martin. You had Chavez on how many of those cards? Those, you know, you're right. Those are some good cards. We have big parties at the house. That was, you know, 16, 17 at the time. My dad would have a lot of his friends come over, and it was like, you know, I'm just ordering pizzas, and I'm watching the fights with all these guys, and the fact that they accepted me to talk boxing with them was great for me as a kid coming up.
Only in America.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of times when you're in the moment, you can get into complaining about where things aren't.
Yeah.
Then, as the years pass on, you realize how good those times really were.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if you compare the Don King, Bob Arum 80s and 90s to a lot of what goes on now in terms of just what you get for your money, it was much, much better when you only had those guys doing most of the big events.
Right.
Because there were no issues with different networks and promoters, and if you had a contract with this network and this manager and this promoter, HBO, for the most part, they took all the promoters and they let them compete. And you got a lot of fights done, a lot of great fights back in the 80s and 90s. Not that you got them all, but you certainly got a lot more than you do now. There was a lot less divisiveness and division then than there is now.
Well, Harvey, as we're talking, I just got a press update, and I don't know how long ago this broke, but you might be getting another big assignment soon because Errol Spence is invoking his rematch clause.
I heard that earlier today. Yes. Wow. Yes. I wish him the best. I just hope he's healthy.
It was rough to watch.
And, you know, when you come back off a very serious accident like he was in, you know, who knows how much that really physically and emotionally affected him. I mean, you get some guys that come back from stuff like that and they do well. One of my favorites, Vinny Paz, came back from that. But other guys, you know, that does a lot of damage.
Right. Yeah. It takes a certain special kind of guy just to get himself back in shape and get in the ring and win a title after going through that anyway. I would imagine 99% of the fighters wouldn't be even fought again after that, let alone capturing a title like he did, I believe, in the Ugas fight, and then going on to fight in a big mega fight like he did in his last fight. It's just a certain special kind of individual he is, just to be able to come back from that. And yes, I think you're right in comparing his ordeal to many pads. I don't think probably one in a million persons would have, after having their neck broken like many pads, would have come back and fought, let alone fought successfully.
Right.
When I talk about Vinny a lot,
He looked like a little devil. And then when I met Vinny, I showed him the picture. I told him the story. And then we became close enough on Facebook and social media. We communicated with each other. Well, my dog died. He sent me a personal condolence. And so I tell people, you know, how, you know, I was a fan of Vinny growing up. And I tell them to watch the movie Bleed for this. And when I tell him, I said, there's going to be some things that that was not historically accurate, like he didn't fight Durant first, and when he won against Gilbert Delay, it was the 12th round, not the second round. But the one thing that is, as I said, the one thing they changed was the length of time it took him to start training again, which they made it over like a couple weeks. When he came out, it was about 4 days after I got home. He goes, I couldn't sit still. He wanted to make it look a little bit longer than it was, so we could have been paralyzed. You know, he said, when can I fight again? They said, you may never walk again. They put the halo on. I said, and in 11 months, almost, he was fighting again. They're like, that's impossible. I said, well, it's not impossible because I witnessed it live. I remember he won Delay. I remember the accident, which was in, like, December, a few weeks later. And I remember his first fight back on USA Tuesday Night Fights. I can still see him running to the ring. Yeah. And they're like, well, how long did he fight? I'm like, 11 years. They're like, that's not true. I'm like, it is true because I went to two of the fights, and I followed his career, and I watched his retirement fight.
We had a great conversation with Vinny, too, after the Marciano statue dedication. And we were all, like, hanging out at the stadium. And there was like a big VIP party across the street at some other building, and like we couldn't even get in. And it was just so funny because like it was just all three of us, like we were all regular guys. he was asking us where the party is. It was funny.
Yeah.
Talking about that green belt too. He always wanted the green belt. So it was funny.
Yeah, he wanted the green belt. Well, I think the thing that Vinny was when he met my dad. I think he saw a lot of his dad who had passed away in my dad. Because after I met Vinny at the one fight card, his book had come out the following year, and I wanted to get a copy for my dad, but I didn't know how to order online at the time. You know, I didn't do much of that. It was like late 2000s, like 2008 to 2009. And I'm like, I never used Amazon at the time, never, didn't have an account. So I'm like, I still got his number from the rich and I interviewed him. I said, I'm just going to call him. He's like, yo, Tony Tornado, how you doing? And I said, hey, I want to get this book for my dad. I said, but I don't know how to do it. He goes, you ever use Amazon? I said, all the time, Vinny. I almost never did. He goes, well, if you order it, here's my address. Send it to me, and I'll sign it for your dad. And he did, you know, which I thought was great. And he goes, give your dad my best. And he never met him. So a couple of years later, we're at the statue dedication. Now, we don't know he's going to be there. It's a New England event and a New England guy, Italian. Put two and two together, likely. But we don't know. My dad, not thinking, puts on a Vinny Paz shirt that I had bought him for Christmas the 1 year that he lost. was like no material anymore. So I see Vinny, I'm talking to him, and I said, Vinny, here comes my dad. I'd like to introduce you. He looks at my dad, seeing his likeness on my dad's shirt. And he runs over and gives him the biggest bear hug. Oh, my God, it's so great to meet you, sir. He's like, to my dad, it's great to meet you.
Yeah.
They took a picture. I sent the picture in a Ring magazine. They got it published. And then a few years ago, we're out in Vegas for the Canelo-Danny Jacobs fight.
Right.
And I was going to that convention. I was telling you about Ray Leonard there and Roy Jones there. So I see Vinny coming in. He looks over and he sees me. Tony T, what the hell is going on? Why is your dad not with you right now? I was wondering how to your dad. And I'm like, well, Vinny, he's back at the hotel relaxing because, you know, he's chilling a little bit because we're going to go to the fights in a little bit. He wanted us, you know, catch his breath. What are you doing? Your dad, I was asking for him.
Tommy Hearns.
Did you?
Yes.
You're right. They had a long line, and I just couldn't make it. And I was a little disappointed.
And I purposely got in the Rory Jones line. Because Rory was a guy that I watched, you know, his whole career, from start to finish. And I got in the Rory line because I wanted to tell him something that he did that I really appreciated. When I was telling you about seeing Andre Ward on the Creed 2 set for that one fight scene, I was sitting front row behind the blue corner. And Rory had come in because he was one of the commentators for that fight. And he was about maybe 30 yards from me, and they were putting his makeup on. And I'm in my scene, they told me I'm a Vegas VIP, and I have to dress like I just came from the craps table. So I got like a shirt on with ties halfway down, got like this vest on, I got a fedora on. And I look over, and Rory and I kind of, you know, lock eyes. Now, he doesn't know me from me interviewing him, you know, a couple years prior. And he said, to him, I'm a stranger. But I turned to him, and I saw him, and he looked at me, and I took my fedora, and I tipped my hat to him. This guy's the champ of the world, one of the best to ever do it. And when I nodded my hat to him, he turned, and he gave me a head bow in response. And I'm like, that meant a lot to me. So when I saw him at that convention taking a photo, I said, I wanted to tell you how much that meant to me.
Those two examples you used, that one with Roy Jones and Vinny Paz wondering where your father was, a lot of these guys are regular human beings.
Yeah.
And it's a treat when you get to see the human element that many of them possess. That's awesome. That's absolutely awesome.
It's like one of the most famous people I've ever interviewed in person was Alice Cooper. And come to find out, he coaches his son's little league team and drives a Volvo. and his kids, wow. His kids call him Alice Cooper when they see him on the stage, but they know him. Right. They distinguish between that as like a different person almost than their father.
Right.
It's funny.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, anyway, Harvey,
I always say about, you know, meeting different people and talking to different people and how much I love doing it. And I actually was a guest on a podcast outside of Philadelphia last week. And the one guy we were talking to, because he was a local legend close to where I grew up, but he trained back in the 40s with Rocky Marciano. Joe Frazier's second pro fight, refereed Marvin Hagler when Hagler was fighting in Philadelphia a couple times. And he had a managerial piece of Michael Graham when Michael fought Lennox Lewis for the title. And for whatever reason, a couple years ago, this man saw me at an event, and he just, maybe the Italian thing, we became friends, and he liked this Phillies Apollo Creed gimmick I do when I go to games. He'd have me come to events all the time. And so when he passed away at 96, he was born 2 months after Rocky in 1923. It'll be Rocky's anniversary of his death today, and Rocky would be 100 years old tomorrow. So rest in peace, Rocky Marciano. Happy 100th in heaven. And this guy, Hank, would have been 100 in November. So we were talking about him, and one of the things he would always say was, he goes, you know, when you meet people, you just do something new, it's going to catch their attention. And you would always have me come to these events, even in January, in a sequined, like, sleeveless hat and cape. And I would always do it. And a couple of years ago, Paul Weathers, played Apollo Creed, was in Philadelphia. And my dad goes, you going to meet him? I said, yeah. He's like, you're not wearing the Apollo outfit, I hope. I said, of course I am. He goes, good, because he goes, if you didn't, if you weren't, I was going to tell you don't have the guts to do it. I catch his attention, you know, doing that, and we take a photo, we talk for a few minutes. I'm like, I'm talking to a guy that, like, I've watched so many times over the years. And then this year, I go to Clearwater in Florida. I go to a meet and greet with Hulk Hogan, who I grew up watching. And I said to him, I said, I'm coming to your karaoke night, and I'm dressing as the Thunderlips character from Rocky. And last year,
I was in there, I don't get called up to swim. And I had to run up and grab his hand for a photo. This year, you're coming, right? I said, I'll be there. This year, they're like, yeah, bro, you're second in queue. He's not even here yet. When he came in, he actually sought me out. And someone's like, how do you get to do that? I'm like, well, because one, I'm personable. But two, I have something that's a little bit unique. And I'm not afraid to put myself out there and say, I'm going to come in here and I thunder with Kate. Or I'm going to come in here dressed as Apollo Creed.
That is so awesome. The Rocky series is probably my favorite of any movie that I've ever watched. So when you mention Rocky,
oh God, they made a new friend now.
My heart vibrates a little bit.
Well, like I said, I'm a Philly guy, so like I go to the Landmarks all the time. Like I've been to the Italian Market. I've been to the art. They do a Rocky 5K every year at the Art Museum. So I started doing it a few years ago, and I'm a guy. I do everything over the top. So there's people that are serious runners, and they got their spandex on and their little shirts and their hats and their headbands and all that. And they're going to put an effort into this 5K or 10-mile or 13-mile marathon or whatever. I am not. You know, I'm 40 years old now. I wasn't a runner when I was 170 pounds. I ain't a runner now, but I'm going to give you a good shot. So the first year, I did a black and gold Italian stallion robe, a fedora, tape my hands up, black and gold trunk. Someone thinks you're going to run like that? Of course. And I did a decent show. I said, nope, I got a one-off it. And I now run in a costume foam muscle suit, a pair of red compression socks pulled up to my calves with laces put in them and tassels. I got the blonde wig, the white fedora with a feather in it, and the Thunderlips cape. And I run dressed as Thunderlips.
Oh, wow. Thunderlips in the flesh.
This year, I'm actually putting a team together that runs in November. I'm putting a team together. We are going to be the ultimate meatballs.
Oh, that is so cool. Hey, keep me posted. I would do it. I run 5 and 10Ks. So,
yeah,
keep me posted. I come out there and run it. That'll be fun.
No, awesome. I'll tell you right now, it's November the 11th. If you are on Facebook, look up Rocky Run. And you'll find just in the event they have the I was getting off the train last year because I leave my house. I'm about 40 minutes outside the city. So I take the train down so I don't go to park. So I get on the train. It's pitch black. It's like 4 in the morning. I'm getting on the train. And I'm at the same stop, and I could see he's a runner. He was from like Yugoslavia or somewhere, one of the Eastern Bloc countries. He's like, oh, I run a marathon every week. He's like, I do 13 mile this week. I'm going to do 26 mile next week. I'm like, oh, God bless you, buddy. I'm doing a 5K dressed up like an idiot.
Right. Oh, that's good. I have a former boxing teammate of mine who lives in Kansas City, Missouri now. He's like, he goes, bro, you're not going to believe this. I'm like, what? He goes, I'm watching CNN, and they were doing a thing in Philadelphia about this Rocky Run, and who do I see going up the steps? You.
Hey, you know, no, I'm serious. I'm going to lift up Rocky Run. I may do it.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the whole series. So yeah, I was on
the
podcast that I filmed last week. We were talking about it when I said earlier about when I had ruptured my appendix and my one former opponent was looking out for me at the audition. Right. I'm sitting there thinking, I'm a boxer and I'm Italian. Maybe they'll put me in the gym hitting the heavy bags. So I get a transmission and the casting director goes, do you want to read? I said, read me? Okay, sure. She goes, I could see you being a white trash thug in a bar. I said, compliment. I will. I don't get the part. I see the guy that did and I still hate him to this day. So I was on set 2 days. But I was an unpaid extra, and and I was at the art museum for the credits, and I get tested. And I could see my arm in like 1/10 of a second, and 1/3, I'm like, that's my arm. So I'm really bitter. Then they're taking auditions for Creed, and I'm like,
same boxing teammate from Lock Haven. His name is Chuck Masaccio. He was 18 and something as a pro.
Yeah, I'm familiar with him. He's from New Jersey.
Yeah, Chuck. Yeah, I actually helped train him when he started at Lock Haven. There's Chuck in the gym with the heavy bag. I'm like, you son of a bitch. I sent my thing in, and they're like, oh, yeah, I remember you. You're the appendix guy. Front row of the Adonis Creed, Danny Stuntman Wheeler, a.k.a. Andre Worfley.
Right.
You can see him. Yeah, I verified it. He's in the movie.
I'll get the DVD and I'll sign it for my nephew, Uncle Tornado, Best Supporting Extra.
Not many people get to become extras in the Rocky movie, so that was pretty cool.
And we got to interview Mason Dixon. Was that the guy's name in the movie?
Yeah.
Antonio Tarver. I got Antonio Tarver on the show for Tony years ago.
Yeah.
Not too long after that movie. That was great.
Okay. We interviewed Antonio probably about 10 years ago, and you know, another fun one to talk to. Great personality. When he was the other pro at the Blue Horizon, my dad was actually working corners that night, and they were in the same locker room. And then he was actually, I don't know if you recognize, there was a coach from Lock Haven passed away last year. His name was Dr. Ken Cox.
Okay, no, I'm not familiar with him.
Okay, Dr. Cox, actually, he would have turned 90 today. He was one of the team managers of the 96 team. So he would come back and he would tell us stories about all the guys on that team. Tarver, David Reed, Vargas. And he said, we had this one pain in the ass kid on the team, this young kid. All he wanted to do was bum quarters from the other fighters so he could play arcade games. That turns out to be Floyd Mayweather.
And so, when
Dr. Cox died last year, because Antonio and I had talked a couple times on Instagram, and he's like, oh, you were one of Doc's boxers. I remember you. And I was the one that broke the news to him that he had passed.
Wow.
When we interviewed him, the first thing I said was, I said, Antonio, I knew a guy from the 96 team, one of the managers, and I did an imitation. Like,
Antonio, what are you doing? You're not going to get ready for this fight. You're not going to make weight.
And he goes, you know Dr. Cox.
Yeah. He's got such a great personality.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So cool.
Good guy.
He's so cool. Yeah. I actually was on the national circuit. I won a couple of local tournaments in New Jersey and was on the national circuit when he was out there. And he's always been such a cool, cool dude.
Mm-hmm.
And a killer in that ring. Boy, in that amateur circuit, baby. You didn't want to be in that light heavyweight division because he was knocking everybody out. Oh, he was vicious.
Yeah.
But just a nice, cool guy.
Yeah. Last time I saw him personally was at the, speaking of Danny Jacobs, it was the Danny Jacobs Sergio Moore rematch, which was September of 16 in Reading, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a 40th birthday gift for me was ringside tickets to that.
Nice.
And Antonio was doing color commentary when he was walking out. I went over to say hi to him, and I did the Dr. Cox impersonation. He goes, yep, I remember you from doing the interview.
I actually saw him last month. He was at the Crawford Spence fight, and I saw him in the hotel lobby. And we embraced it. I was just glad to see it. But, yeah, still a nice, cool guy.
Awesome. All right, Harvey, we're gonna let you go. But it's been amazing talking to you. We could go on forever. I'm sure we probably got to do a second interview at some point. Get into some other topics. But it's just amazing getting your perspective too of a professional referee, like Tom said. You know, you did a great job in that Spence fight. And tell people where they can find you online for our listeners that want to see more of you.
I'm more on Facebook at all. I believe it's either @CarlBeHarvey. I don't have a Instagram, and I'm on Twitter @CarlBe.
Awesome. And it said that you're a journalist on the Facebook page. What are you doing with the journalism? You coming up with a book?
That was a long time ago. That means my Facebook needs to be updated. I'm assistant superintendent on a construction site now.
Oh, all right. That's different. A little different than writing.
Yes. I haven't written in a good little while, but just need to update that.
Yeah, sometimes you just got to pick it up again. You never know.
Facebook right now, and one of our mutual friends is a guy that I was actually at the one the center with this morning. He was actually at the Spence Crawford fight. So I saw him like a week later. I'm like, hey, man, I haven't seen you. I'm like, hey, what do you think of that fight last week? He's like, bro, I was there.
Yeah, who is this?
His name is Donald Lyons.
Okay.
He showed me a picture of you and him at the fight.
Donald Lyons, okay. All right. Sounds good.
All right, Harvey, we will keep in touch, and I'll shoot you a link when we get this posted, and we'll promote it across Facebook and our social networks. And we also have a website. We got Spreaker, where we do this podcast, and then we take the interviews separate, and we put them on Blog Talk Radio, our profile there, where we got most of our big-time interviews. And we got our most listened-to interview was like 20,000 listens in like a week, and that was Hector Camacho Jr. the week after his dad got shot. Yeah, that was a very emotional interview. That was good stuff. Anyway, great to have you, and awesome conversation. Look forward to chatting again at some point. And now, I'm glad I lost on the auction.
I'm gonna keep going.
Yeah. I bet you would have. That's why I ducked out.
No, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good one.
All right, thanks, guys. See you. Have fun.